Welcome to Leave Your Mark, where I explore the influences that have shaped the lives of our incredible guests. These are the stories of lives worth talking about. Follow me on Twitter at Built by Scott and Instagram at King O'Pain, or link up with me on my Facebook fan page at Scott G. Livingston. My goal is to create a community of people who take every opportunity to live high-performing lives. Before I get started on today's podcast, I want to take a moment to connect you with my sponsor, ReconditioningHQ.com.
Reconditioning is now completely virtual. This amazing operating system that brings the worlds of therapy and performance together in one powerful package can now be digested from the comfort of your home or personal workspace. Reconditioning is about unleashing the human in human performance. It's about understanding why you or your clients are not performing or living your best life and giving you and your clients the skills for optimal performance. Our courses, R1 Foundations, and R2 Designs take you through a complete process in assessment and intervention. Reconditioning Specialist Mentorship pulls everything together in your operating context, and our landmark program, Empower You, helps you navigate your own life so you can be your very best. For more information about reconditioning courses and programs, head over to reconditioninghq.com and use the coupon code LYM50 for $50 off the price of any one of our empowering courses. Most recently, Matrix Fitness Canada partnered with Playball Academy Canada in Kitchener, Ontario to create the Matrix Conditioning Center. The Matrix Conditioning Center within the facility provides PBA athletes and coaches access to the best and most current conditioning tools to support their development. By combining the Matrix research on product usage with customized needs of the coaches, simple performance metrics are being developed in a body-friendly and progressive way. It is a hybrid model combining high-performance metric analysis with coach-friendly opportunities. Speed training, sprint mechanics, coaching, metabolic conditioning, warm-up, and cool-down are all some of the examples of how these tools are being used. Playball Academy Canada was established in 2014 and has developed into one of the premier indoor baseball training facilities in the country. From grassroots player and skill development to the pro level, the facility and its programming continue to evolve and grow. Matrix Fitness is a global brand of fitness equipment that serves exercisers and operators from all corners of the globe. When it comes to sport performance, Matrix portfolio continues to grow through its partnership with amateur and professional sports organizations globally. To get more information on how Matrix Fitness can customize something for your team, contact Matrix directly at greg.lawler@matrixfitness.com and tell them Leave Your Mark sent you.
Hello and welcome to Leave Your Mark. I'm Scott Livingston, and today I have the honor of speaking with Matt Bush. Matt is the owner of Next Level Neuro, a neuroscience-based health and performance coaching company that works with athletes, executives, and entrepreneurs to develop their brain health and highest levels of performance. He also works as a specialized business consultant to entrepreneurs focused on improving their communication, teaching, and coaching skills through applied neurology. His career passion is teaching others why and how the brain works so they can unlock the next level of their best life. Matt and his wife Kathy live in Phoenix, Arizona. I'm delighted to have him on the show today. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
It is definitely warmer where you are than where I am right now. So I am in Mont Tremblant. We are getting into the teens of the minuses right now. So the beautiful temperatures. But then you guys deal with crazy hot temperatures in the summertime. So, you know,
absolutely.
So thanks for taking the time today. You know, we bumped into each other through mutual friends, Brian and Carrie, and come to know some of the things that you do in the neuroscience world. I just want to sort of kind of discover how Matt became Matt and what he does now. Where did you grow up and what was life like in your childhood with, you know, activity, life, et cetera?
Yeah. I grew up around Atlanta, Georgia. Okay. Actually, I'm a Southern boy. And always lived in the South. I was born in Alabama, but we lived most of my childhood and teenage years in Atlanta. Mom and dad were both at home. Dad was a preacher, actually. So I'm
really?
Also.
Wow.
Mom worked for the school system. So she was at the school where my brother and I were in our younger years. You know, so I have one sibling, one brother, who's younger than me. And so, you know, I think life was pretty normal. Happy family life, you know, And I was very early on, my brother and I got into sports. Mm-hmm. And so we were both multi-sport athletes all the way through high school and then headed into college. And that really became the focus of our time, really, other than whatever schoolwork had to get done. you know, if the weather was nice, he and I were outside playing baseball or football or basketball, depending on what season it was. Mm-hmm. And then as we got into middle school and high school, it was always time spent at practice for whatever sport was in season. And so,
With your father as a preacher, was that, what was that influence on you? Was it, was he more of kind of about academics or, you know, the stewardship of life on a day-to-day basis? How did that influence you growing up?
He was actually, he was the introduction to our athletics. Hmm. So he had been an athlete himself. He's also a musician. Hmm. And his preaching vocation was more, I like to say now that he's really mellowed out a lot as he's aged. But, you know, when we were kids, it was a lot about obedience and, you know, doing the right thing. And he instilled a very strong work ethic in my brother and I. But also a very strong sense of ethics and morals that you should be living right, you know, for whatever rules or guidelines that would present. Mm. My brother and I were just a little bit competitive and often ended up fighting together. So Dad was the disciplinarian, you know, but what the other interesting piece of that, thinking about his preaching life, is we had a constant rotation of people coming into the house who were in need. And that could be people from church. That could be people that he met in town, total strangers that would come in and sit down with our family for a meal, for dinner, or, you know, they would stay in our basement for 6 weeks while they were in between homes. Mm. So a sense of service was also kind of always present because of his nature and his job. Mm.
Well, you mentioned in the note to me before we met that, you know, teaching has always been something that seemed innate to you. Do you think the influence of him being an orator or a mentor himself was, you know, made you sort of tick that way? Or do you think that's just in your heart of hearts?
No, I do think it definitely pushed me in that direction. I didn't know it was at the time, though. Mm. I can look back on it now and say, absolutely. At the time, I kind of got the teaching bug maybe toward the end of high school because I had some really good teachers. My brother and I transitioned from public elementary school into a private school at around sixth grade, middle school age. But what actually opened my eyes that my dad was a teacher was not his Sunday sermons, but he actually was working at the private school where we were going, teaching Bible classes because it's a Christian school. Hmm. And I got assigned to his Bible class in my junior year of high school. So Dad's my teacher. And that's actually where I realized that he is such a masterful teacher himself. And so my junior year and my senior year being in his class, and then funny enough, ironically, anatomy and physiology. Mm. I had no idea that I wanted to go into anything regarding human health and performance at that time, and wouldn't for years to come. But my A&P teacher was probably my favorite teacher. Other than my dad in my entire high school career.
What did you, it's kind of an, I want to unpack the question a little bit, but when you were being taught, what did you find was a quality teacher? And then how have you converted that into your belief system around what is a quality teaching experience now?
Yeah. Really good question, but the answer comes immediately to mind. The first thing is a sense of authenticity, of caring about the material and about the students. And second is, as a teacher, actually being a good listener. Both of those teachers, including my dad and my other teacher, their sense of being able to listen to the question that the students were asking and get to the heart of the question is probably what made them such great influences in my life. That they weren't just delivering material, but they were making it applicable at the same time.
Right, making
sure that their students really understood what they were talking about.
And so how were you then influenced in your educational pathway moving forward? Where do you go and what do you do as a late teen, early 20s?
It is a long and winding path.
Yeah.
So I went into college thinking that I was going to go into ministry. And it wasn't necessarily teaching. I didn't quite understand the difference between teaching and, you know, maybe public speaking at the time, or role model versus, you know, helping people apply information. So I thought I was going to go into ministry, and particularly youth ministry. So I started off my higher education at a very small Christian university in Arkansas. And I was there for about a year and decided not to stay, moved to California. But essentially what I did for the next 3 or 4 years is while completing my school, I was either interning or employed at a church in youth ministry, campus ministry, worship ministry, some other type of form at all times, kind of for the next 4 or 5 years. Because what I figured out at some point in that journey is it did fulfill that desire to teach.
Right.
Okay. That started to kind of crystallize a little bit. And I go, you know, what really energizes me or what's fulfilling and contributing is when I'm teaching.
Okay.
That became a little bit more clear.
So why do you lose faith in faith, so to speak, and not that you're losing faith in it, but you lose faith in the idea that you want to do that versus go somewhere else?
Yeah. Essentially what happened is I decided I didn't want ministry to become my primary means of financial support, you know, my primary income. Just my experience in the places that I was at, but, and some of us watching how my dad had acted, lived, and also been treated by others as I was growing up as a kid at home. But I found the churches that I was working with to be a little too political and somewhat draining of energy for me. And what I mean by that is if I want to teach and I want to help people, but what I'm allowed to do, how much exposure I can have, you know, who gets to pull the strings of power
right
within those church environments, that was a little difficult for me. And I went, you know, if ministry is the goal, if that's where I'm headed, I don't want that to be contingent on my ability to still get paid because I play by the rules that this particular church has created.
Right.
And if I don't play by the rules, I lose the job, I lose my income, regardless of how effective the ministry was. That created kind of a conflicting interest for me. And so, you know, after 4 or 5 years of that path, I was like, I think it's time to move away because, and I even borrowed this from my dad. You know, he still to this day says he does ministry every day of the week and he doesn't let preaching get in the way of that.
That's a good way to look at it for sure. So you then pivot where then at that point?
I was kind of lost for a little bit. You know, in the midst of that, I had finished my bachelor's degree in religion. I had started a master's degree in religion, which is technically called a Master of Divinity program. And that program is designed to either let you go into academia or to go into ministry. You can go for a PhD or you can, you know, get a job. So when I decided to leave ministry, I was like, maybe I'll try the academia route. And so I kind of started looking into PhD programs, got a job as an adjunct professor at a university where I was at. And So I floundered. This is the truth. The adjunct professorship didn't go very well. I didn't want to really finish the master's degree. Ended up finishing it anyway, but I was just kind of burned out at that point. So eventually got a job in IT.
Wow.
As a computer analyst. Like, toss it all out the window and let's do something different.
And what gives you acumen or the nuts to decide to do that out of the blue?
a little bit of the computer knowledge was there just from growing up around computers. And
right.
I was of that generation of the first ones to really grow up with the computer in the household all the time and have that access. But then, truth be told, it was connections that got me the job. But what I learned there is I was in a position where I was essentially a translator. And this is something that I had mentioned earlier, a translator between the department of university professors who don't speak computer at all and the IT department who don't speak everyday English at all. And so if the department needs technology help, I'm the guy, I'm the middleman, you know, to make the appropriate request of the IT department. If IT needs to implement some new security feature or software platform, I'm the guy to teach everyone how to use it. Mm. And so even though this IT thing seemed to be kind of a random shot in the dark, like I just need a job to get paid, I found that I kind of fulfilled a very similar role to teaching or explaining, kind of translating information for people between, two very different fields. So
you started to recognize sort of your sensibility or ability to sort of make something simple that maybe is a little bit more complex or to find the nugget of what is important in the reflection of what's going on. That's a strength of yours that you start to see.
It is. All things kind of tie together. Some of it comes from an ability to listen to what people are really asking for and try to figure out what they're asking for when they don't have the words. and then some of it is seeing the need and kind of stepping into that and going, well, here's what you might be interested in or might need or something like that. But that was an interesting turning point in my life or my career, at least, because it, again, this is a lesson learned in hindsight, but it's one of those where when you walk into the room of a professor who's called you to their office for help or into basically a board meeting of the directors of the IT department. And in either case, you have to answer for what's happening or solve a problem. It really developed a sense of confidence in me that, or more succinctly or more specifically, I would say kind of a sense that I have a belief that if I walk into the room, I'll be able to figure this out.
Mm. That's awesome.
Not necessarily because I know the answers in advance.
Right.
I may have to go back and do some research. But it instilled in me a belief in my ability to figure things out.
That's
and that pushed me to the next levels of my career and the next places that I went.
Mm. And what is the next at this point? You're in IT, but you're scratching and knowing that it's not the right itch, so to speak.
Yep, exactly. So at that point, I reconnected with an old family friend, Kathy, actually, who's now my wife. And she had started a business years before with a business partner teaching neurology. So enter neuro. And they needed IT help. Essentially, at the beginning of our kind of reconnecting and getting to know one another again, because it had been years since we had really interacted, they needed help growing their business, or their business was growing, and they needed the technology to support it.
Right.
So I was living in Malibu, California at the time. They were located in Phoenix. And so essentially I began using my vacation time or paid time off from the university to travel over to Phoenix, work on their technology systems. And then because they were a growing small business, didn't have a huge amount of capital at the time, we agreed to trade services. So I started learning their neurology program in exchange for the work on their tech systems.
Hmm.
And so that was kind of my first introduction to true neuro, was at that point.
So why do you become interested in that? You're in tech and you're doing stuff, and then you could say the same thing about you started doing sort of a web page for a restaurant and then you became a chef. So what is it that strikes you that you're all of a sudden interested in, or you get excited about?
Their own possibility. To some degree, I've always been a tinkerer with my hand in a lot of different interests. I've always been a bit of a jack of all trades. And so stepping into a small business, you don't have a well-defined role. You end up doing a little bit of everything. So that's a little bit of what was enticing about it, is seeing where they could use additional help and how I can step in. Mm. But just the neuroinformation itself was exciting. Mm. At the time. You know, it really spoke to my early years as an athlete, to, you know, several of the exercises or drills or practice techniques that I had used that I didn't really understand as a kid. And now they're being explained from a neurological perspective. Mm-hmm. And then as I stuck around a little longer, what really drew me in was understanding how few people in the health and fitness industries understand, not even understand the information, but even know that it exists.
Right.
There was a huge gap between the neurology that has been published and the understanding of people who are in the field.
Yeah.
And so it kind of calls to that teacher, translator, you know, that person who's inside of me who goes, I can really make a difference here.
Well, I'm going to use that moment to pivot to a piece that I do in my podcast. I don't know if you've ever listened to my podcast, probably not, but this is a book called The Day You Were Born. It was written by a woman named Linda Joyce, who's an astrologer and numerologist. And I discovered the book a number of years ago, and kind of each date that you're born, it gives you kind of your purpose. And then there's a quote that goes with it and sort of a descriptor. And I've found fascinating when I read it to my guests that 9 out of 10 times they go, holy Jesus, are you kidding me? And the reason I bought the book was I had a quote on my desktop for years. Some men see things as they are and say why. I dream things that never were and say why not. And when I went to read the book, I'm a Sag 2 and Sag, I'm a Sag 3, and I read the purpose and I'm like, whoa, that's strong. And then that quote was there and I'm like, oh, this is crazy, I gotta buy this book. So for you, you're a Sagittarius 7, born December 7th, which when did you discover that was the day of infamy, so to speak? That did you know that from very early on how important that date was in your
probably,
life?
Probably. I heard that from family members well before I understood what it meant.
Yeah.
And so I was probably 6, maybe 7 the first time. And I think it was my grandfather who introduced the idea because he was a veteran. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea what he was talking about. But pretty early.
Big day in American history for sure.
Yeah.
So you're a Sag 7. Your purpose is to create through the power of your beliefs something divine, something that uplifts the soul of man. You have in your composition a mighty genius for expression, which has escaped discipline, H.G. Wells. The Sagittarius 7 lives in a world of beauty, imagination, and fantasy. When they learn how to ground themselves, they can be geniuses. The Sagittarius 7 either affects change in the world or follows some great idea or person they believe has these powers. They need to remember it is always dangerous to give away personal power. They feel the need to contribute something meaningful to the world. However, the other extreme is possible. The Sagittarius 7 can be a dictator. They are psychic and may have vivid predictive dreams or even experience visits from angels. They need all the reality they can get. Once their feet are on the ground, their spirits are free to soar. Interesting.
Okay. Yeah.
little fun divine piece for you there to associate with your divine past, so to speak.
Yeah. That word tends to come up far more often in my life than I would ever expect. Or predict. The contribution in that also rings very true.
Then it creates it. Like, I get the deep impression that you really want to make, you know, a contribution, as you said, in what you bring to the table from an educational knowledge base perspective to the community at large.
Yeah.
So, you know, given that, that area of practice is still sort of a black box for a lot of people. And there's been a lot of research, I would say, in the last 10 years. It's become very much, much heavier. And as I mentioned, I'm trying to get to Andrew Huberman on the podcast as well. And he's doing some really great work at Stanford. And there's all kinds of great researchers who are doing some neat things. And so there's a lot of work going on in the research world, but at the same time, it's hard. Sometimes the ability to take that research or that technical dialogue and dial it down to the mass, not even the mass, but the practitioners who actually deliver this stuff it can be challenging. And the performance industry has always been sort of, I would call it a nuts and bolts sort of parameters, you know, the muscles, the training systems, all this kind of stuff. And this ability to understand that black box has been a challenge. And sometimes it gets perceived as the woo and the voodoo stuff that's out there that people don't really understand. So yeah. I'm going to complicate the question, but hopefully we'll play through it. How have you been able to distill this down to something that's relatively simple, but at the same time, you know, stays with the truth of what is evidence-based and what we know and understand of what is maybe woo at the same time?
Matrix Fitness is a global brand of exercise equipment managed locally in the countries it serves. In Canada, Matrix Fitness has 56 employees, 4 offices, a technical support team across Canada covering all regions and serving some of the biggest fitness and hospitality brands in your community. In 2021, Matrix will celebrate its 20th anniversary and 6th year within Canada. An emerging market for Matrix is its sport performance and athletic training portfolio. While Matrix Fitness has gained significant momentum in the fitness market, strength and conditioning is evolving, and for that they need to collaborate with some good people. In the second half of 2020, Matrix launched its own Canadian Ambassador Program, a partnership that looks to do exactly that, work with good people who serve athletes. This is an opportunity to be part of a growing and emerging brand in the ever-changing industry of sport performance. For more information on their ambassador program and exploring the details of how it might work for you, please contact the Vice President of Business Development, Greg Lawler. Please reference the Leave Your Mark podcast and reach out to Greg at greg.lawler@matrixfitness.com.
3 things come to mind almost immediately. And you kind of have to put them all together. It doesn't work if you only have one of the pieces. Mm-hmm. The first is a framework to understand all the information that's out there on neurology. I believe people tend to think of neurology as overwhelming and confusing and somewhat random, mm-hmm. That they don't know how the pieces fit together or what the cause and effect chain, you know, the chain of events is. But neurology is actually very organized and very predictable if you have a framework to understand it. Mm-hmm. Without getting into a huge amount of detail, the most simple framework we can understand about neurology is your nervous system receives inputs, it interprets what they mean, and then it creates outputs. And with that alone, we can take a look at, if I'm talking to a professional, I can say we can take a look at our training protocols or our rehab and our therapy and everything else and simply ask the question, where are we focusing our attention? Mm-hmm. Are we just trying to correct the output by focusing on the output? Or are we going back in the chain of events to look at the interpretation and decision-making or even to look at the inputs? Because if we change either of those, the output it necessitates change. It must change the output. So framework is first. Mm-hmm. Very, very important. The second is, I lost my train of thought. Can you repeat the question?
Well, it's kind of like how have you come to this place where you understand like how this information gets delivered so that we're actually, we're staying in a place of, I don't like the word truth, but a place of, and I don't like the word evidence-based either. I think at the end of the day, there's what it really does. And then there's the stuff that sometimes gets elaborately interpreted to sort of bring, you know, cool perspective to the phenomena of what we're doing. But there is still, and that's where I think where this is so important and why, you know, we don't need to get into the details, but I think for the listener, because a lot of the listeners that I have are performance professionals, I think because it seems complex and because there's some level of interpretation of what's going on, some people perceive that as there's too much woo, so I'm not going to go there. And then instead of embracing what is truthful about it and what we really can practically apply, it gets kind of dumped in this black box space and nobody really goes there. So it's kind of how do we, what are the pieces? And you talked about structured framework, but what are the pieces that would allow us better for people to embrace it?
Okay. So, framework is one. Second is we need, in order to be able to test it, whether this is in a peer-reviewed study or in a practical application with clients or athletes, we need a way to test if the exercises or drills we're doing are working. Mm. So the ability to reassess the nervous system, you know, to decide what is your observable threshold of change, what do you actually need to be looking at, and then know how to interpret that and know what it means. So, you know, we can look at biomechanical efficiency, which smoothness of movement, speed of movement, control of movement. We could look at, you know, actual objective measurable outcomes, mm-hmm. like strength output or range of motion, an active range of motion, things that we can actually measure, you know. So the ability to assess and reassess does pull it out of the woo category, mm-hmm. And allow us to apply it. And it also gives us the clarity to know when the tools are working, but also when to not apply the tools, which, it may be a bit of a tangent to say this, but a lot of education that I've been exposed to, it teaches you the tools, but it doesn't always teach you when to not use the tools. And I think for practitioners, part of the reason that neuro and a whole lot of other training modalities are confusing is they all get taught as if they're the answer to the problem.
Right.
And what we need is a way to sort through and sift through all of the possible tools in the toolbox to figure out which ones actually don't apply versus which ones do.
Well, I think I'm really kind of cool. It's nice that you went there because I think we started our conversation before we came on kind of talking about silos of professional, you know, right. what do you call yourself and everything else. And I think the educational process of that makes sense. There's a requirement to specialize, to understand, you know, the information to a degree. But I think the weakness of that system over time is that people get into their silos and then they're kind of like unwilling or unable to express laterally what's really going on. And when you fundamentally look at the body, the physical and the mental are married. They're not too discrete, you know, and I think for a long time we've had the psychology, sports psychology over here, and we've got the performance guys over here, and we've got the nutrition people here, and they're commingled, you know, and we're even seeing some of the stuff around digestive processes and things like some people talking about your gut being the second brain kind of things these days. So what have you sort of discovered in the process of, you know, you're learning that maybe for the listener, we need to open our mind up better to around all those things.
It's the adopting the idea that it's okay to be what I call a specialized generalist. And once you understand how the nervous system works, I kind of put it out this way. I go, look, your nervous system, it ultimately either controls or is involved in every process that happens in your body. You can't separate the nervous system from your immune system, your digestion, your emotions, your thoughts, your physical actions, your biomechanics. And depending who I'm talking to and how facetious or sarcastic I want to be, I'm like, look, you can't, if you dig deep enough into a muscular system, physically or metaphorically, you're going to run into a nervous system. You can't avoid it.
Yeah.
You know? And so once we understand that it's a governor or a controller, that it is involved in everything that we do, and rather than that lateral movement of silos, it becomes a bit more of an umbrella lens. And now we can understand how those silos all fit together and how they interact. But that takes pulling silos, a really great term, because you have to pull yourself out of that a bit and go, as I learn more about the nervous system and how it's involved in all of these different areas, I do have to give up a little bit of the specificity in order to become a generalist. And know that my mood and my sleep, they can affect my digestion, and that can affect my psychology and my emotions, and that can affect my physical performance, and that can affect my levels of pain, you know, and that can then affect my mood and my sleep. And oh, now we're in a giant circle. You know, it's a big loop.
Yeah.
But one of the important things about neurology is to understand all of neurology is loops. It's that input output, and the output is going to generate new inputs. So anytime you have a loop, it's always the question of where's the best place to insert stimulus in order to affect what the loop is doing. As the all silos start to fit together, it gives you a lot more options of thinking of what do I need to address.
Yeah. Where do you sit now as opposed to maybe before in your life on the idea of nature nurture? Do you think that, you know, we come out and we're kind of like an open canvas and it's all the different stimuli that we that are applied to us that create us? Or do you think that there's a certain amount of nature that defines how that stimulus is adopted, adapted to, and refined within us?
Tricky question.
Yeah.
You know, I'll give you the opinion answer, but then I'll give you another idea too. Of course, you have to kind of think it's both. But the question is, where does the line fall between them, at least for me? If I just put a number out there, I think probably 90% of it is nurture. Probably 6 or 7 years ago, I had a conversation with one of the leading genetic researchers in the United States who said, if we're looking at athletic performance, generally about 11 to 13% of athletic performance is based on genetics. Size of the body, length of the lever, you know, the fast twitch and slow twitch muscle, all of those types of things, there's a genetic marker for those. So yes, some of the physical structure is based on nature, but that leaves 85 to 90% that's nurture. And we can go back to our super basics of physiology and look at how the body adapts to stimulus, how tissues change, how skeletal structure changes, and we can see stimulus drives adaptation. So I think it's far more nurture than it is nature. And what most people don't understand, or only because they've never been exposed to it, is the idea that every second of the day, you're being exposed to stimulus, either on purpose or on accident, and your nervous system is always adapting to that stimulus that's occurring. So in a very joking way, my teacher in neurology used to say, the body you have is the body you've earned by the way that you move. Congratulations. Like, I hope you like it. Your own fault. And there's exceptions to that, obviously, for injuries and accidents and stuff. But for most people, the way we move, what we eat, what we do day to day has crafted the body that we have. The same is true for your neurology. So I think it's probably about 90% nurture is where I fall in that conversation.
So what did you fall in love with in this subject matter that's kind of kept you in that space again pivoting again?
It builds on the question you just asked. It is the adaptation. The whole idea of neuroplasticity, that the brain has the ability to change and in fact does continue to change until the day that you die. What that means when you begin to apply it is if you're not dead, you're not done. So you can change your nervous system and all of the things that it controls at any point in your life. Years ago, Kathy actually came up with the phrase that said it's the science of hope for people. Science tells us you can change your brain. We know your brain controls or is involved in every single process in your body, which means everything that goes on inside of you can be changed, or everything that comes out of you can be changed. It's that glimmer of hope that change is possible, that you're not stuck, that is the most emotionally drawing and exciting to me to go. That's what people really need in their life is to know you don't have a bad knee because it's been hurting for 20 years. You have an uneducated brain, or an uninformed brain about the current state of your knee. You don't have a weight problem. You have a nervous system that's gotten habituated to being a certain size. You don't have an emotional problem. You have an inability to work through those things because you've never learned how. And granted, those are all blanket statements. There's certainly like chemical and physical exceptions to a lot of those things. But like I said, if I really buy into 90% nurture, then I think there's about a 90% chance that we can change whatever you want to change if we can find the right stimulus to drive the adaptation.
That brings me to another question I'm kind of curious about on your journey. I've kind of recognized over time that, whether you're a successful athlete or whether you're a successful business person or whatever we would define as successful, so to speak, a lot of times there's what I call the skeletons in the closet or the difficult challenges that were almost impossible to overcome somewhere in your life that burned something into you that has created this, crystallized this in sort of like a focal point of energy that you put into whatever it is that you do. It becomes the fire that burns within. And this has always been an interesting question for me around with some of my sports psychology brethren is, do you attempt to put to work on the neurology of that person to make them a better functioning human being, but in essence at risk of putting the fire out. And I'm kind of interested what you think of that, like when you actually create the healthy construct, then the thing that was motivating or generating the furnace can disappear. And what do you think of that, or how have you approached that in your career?
I don't think it has to disappear.
Okay.
I used to tell people, and this most often came up with entrepreneurs rather than athletes, but we can apply it to both. Mm. You're working with an entrepreneur who's a quick start, always moving on to the next project, getting things done, juggling a million balls in the air. And they would be self-identifying or diagnosed as having something like ADHD. And they want to work with us to improve their focus or their concentration, but they're afraid that if we improve their ADHD, they'll lose their superpower. And I would always tell them, you're not going to lose your superpower. You're going to actually gain the ability to manage it more appropriately or more optimally. So you can still do your superpower and it doesn't drain your energy at the same time. In regards to that motivator, that fire that you kind of talked about, I think a lot of that motivation, especially when it comes from our past, is an emotional fire that we create that pushes us, right? And I don't think optimizing your brain has to, it's not like we're going to, you know, blink you like Men in Black and totally erase your memory. You're going to keep that emotion. You're going to keep that memory. You're going to keep that story. And those will continue to fuel you, but your capacity, your tool set, your mental abilities would be optimized as, in as much as we can, so that your superpowers become even better because you can use them without them also having such a high cost to your daily life, your energy, your relationships, whatever whatever area it is.
So you run into Kathy in this business situation, and then when do you fall in love with this lady?
Years later.
Years later.
we were friends for a really, really long time. And she eventually sold her shares of the company and left that company. I stayed for a few more years and continued to teach. But it wasn't until after she left the company and everything had kind of cleared out that we started dating and became more interested in one another.
That's cool. Yeah. And what do you see? What is it in her that, that has matched you or makes you a better person, so to speak, or that you recognize made you a better person?
She's brilliant. You know, Brian calls her the smartest person in any room that he's ever been in with her. I've known she's brilliant, and her ability to communicate with people. I think her emotional intelligence is far higher than mine, so she can really connect and build rapport. But she communicates very differently than I do. I'm more of a talk you through the outline and the framework and then give you the details so that you can understand, if you want to call it the brass tacks or the protocol. She communicates in analogies almost entirely, analogies and metaphors. And so we really complement each other in our communication at home, our relationship. We're a bit of the opposites attract kind of thing, where she's more of the extrovert. I'm more of the introvert. but just the way that we can talk for hours has always been something that brings me energy and brings joy to my life.
That's awesome.
What allowed that relationship to bloom.
What has metamorphosized over time in teaching the information that you taught about your method of teaching? Like what do you do differently now that maybe you didn't do 10 years ago or 15 years ago as a teacher?
Excellent question. There's a more of a focus on the framework at the beginning, giving people a big picture or at least know where to place the information in the big picture. Without context, people tend to get a little lost. There's also more focus on practical application. Because we can talk for hours or days or weeks about neurology, but if we don't talk through your personal application for an athlete or a client or for yourself, and you don't know what to do with it, that information is useless. It's there's no value in it if you don't apply it and create change. So those two come to mind. There's also probably a little more entertainment built in. As you're talking about a topic that's inherently a little bit difficult for people. So to make it understandable, you kind of have to keep it light and throw in some really bad jokes. I'm notorious for dad jokes during my teaching or for, you know, busting out in a silly accent, just to make sure people are listening. So, but context and application probably are the actual pedagogical tools that I've added to that teaching to go, we really have to make it useful or else what's the value?
Do you draw a discernment or a differentiation between teaching and coaching in your viewpoint, or are they the same thing?
Absolutely. No, I have a big difference in those two. Coaching is all about day-to-day or weekly application. And the coach, in my opinion, the coach is the cheerleader. Mm. They're the support mechanism. It doesn't matter if I'm working with athletes or entrepreneurs, whether it's a physical gym space or they're at home working on neuro drills on their own. When coaching someone, it's about helping them find the way to be successful doing what it is that they want to do. And my mentor used to say the difference between a coach and a critic is that a critic can tell you what's wrong, but a coach can give you an exercise to help you correct it. Mm. So it's, when I apply coaching and I meet with people weekly or biweekly, it's always, how's the application going? How can I help you be more successful? Where do you need support? What's not working that we need to modify or tweak? And that's all enveloped in a whole lot of cheerleading. Mm. Teaching is much more about imparting information and application to let them know, if it's, especially if it's a professional, what to do, how to do it. Mm-hmm. But the actual implementation of that is left to their own devices.
Right.
So I can teach at a weekend certification or a conference. I wouldn't call that coaching ever. Mm-hmm. And if I'm meeting with someone regularly, I would never think that I was teaching them. I would simply be coaching them to apply the information for their life.
So. Well, this is one of the things I discovered in being, you know, I've felt personally that I have a strength in teaching, but I've also discovered over time that the, call it the storytelling aspect of teaching, that you sometimes need to bring more context to a situation, is something I've discovered more in the last few years. Yeah. I used to be more about sort of, as you said, the brass tacks of the information, finding ways to clarify it for somebody. But, you know, now I'm recognizing, especially when you draw a differentiation between, say, call it the public speaking teaching versus the, you know, you're in a course deep diving on something. Yeah. And you know, what have you discovered in your journey as a teaching professional and a coach about those differences and you know, how you bring acumen to either?
I actually went on to do more continuing education in the world of storytelling because I found I wasn't very good at it. you know, when I think of storytelling in my teaching, whether it's a public speaking engagement or a deep dive, most often what's done in the industry is case studies, and it's more recalling of what happened rather than actually telling a story. Mm. And I found certain people can get on board with that or really apply that information, but it's really just another way of doing brass tacks. Mm-hmm. When I learned more how to apply storytelling, it ends up actually touching everybody in the room much more consistently. Mm. They grasp the information more easily. They really hold on to it and apply it. I learned storytelling from a guy named Bo Eason, who was a former NFL safety.
Yeah, I've heard of him, man.
Broadway star, did a one-man show on Broadway, and then became a teacher of the storytelling method. Mm. And what Bo says about stories, he says the more personal the story is, the more universal it becomes to your audience. So actually getting into the events, instead of telling what happened, actually playing them out, embodying them with physical movement, being generous with your emotions. And as I learned to do more of that, my teaching improved exponentially because I'm not having to, hammer the information into their heads. Mm-hmm. More illustrative of the information. Mm-hmm. And there's a bit more emotion into it. Mm-hmm. And that completely transforms how the teaching experience goes.
Yeah.
So that's something that I still strive to implement as often as I can. And I'm obviously still growing at that. That's not a skill that I've mastered quite yet.
Well, I will say I'm taking the course, the neurology course with you guys right now. And I really enjoy listening to the way you bring the information across. It's quite eloquent. So keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
So that brings me to, you know, if somebody's listening, and they're in the performance world right now, you know, how can they start to inject some of this into the way they work or operate without completely, you know, table flipping their approach, but start to salt and pepper some of this into their game plan and grow from that. And, you know, maybe elaborate on some of the things you're doing in case people want to find you or get involved in some of that stuff.
Sure. The first thing that I would give any professional in the world of health and fitness is an assess, reassess process that is more specific and more frequent than most of those that are applied. Mm-hmm. And to the degree that when I'm working with an athlete, I reassess every single set that we do of an exercise or drill. And it's an assessment of neurological function and or efficiency. So yes, there's going to be fatigue during a training session, but I can still see how their nervous system is handling the load that we've just created. Mm-hmm. Load, various definitions, right? Neurological load, physical load, whatever you want to call it. Because if I'm using exercises or tools that are pushing their nervous system more toward threat or a protective mechanism, they're never going to have their highest level of performance, and they're not going to recover as quickly from something that causes them more tension, more protection, as they would something that is more free and they're able to engage with. So yeah, like when we talk about those outputs from the input output framework that I mentioned earlier, I kind of put outputs on a spectrum and I go, your brain and body can only really do one thing at a time. They can either have high performance or they can engage in survival outputs and protective mechanisms. So that's what this kind of shape comes from. And for years and years and years, we all thought that we had to have lots of pain in order to get really good gains. We now know that's not the case. Mm-hmm. The more pain that we experience, the more that the nervous system actually shuts down. And it takes longer to recover, longer to develop tissue changes, longer to develop motor control, you know, increases or greater levels of motor control. So pain actually inhibits all of the learning process and the physiological process that the body would undergo. So don't move your athletes into pain. But sometimes that's a little too broad sometimes. The assess, reassess process lets us see if baseline was at zero, after I do exercises, am I moving more toward protective mechanisms shutting down, or is it giving me more, greater capacity for movement, strength, flexibility, and power, you know? So learning that is step one. And then neurology follows basically the same ideals as progressive overload training and the idea of a minimal effective dose. When I apply a stimulus to a nervous system, if it's a stimulus it can already handle with no additional thought, there's not going to be an adaptation. If I give it a moderate amount of stimulus, then it will drive the adaptation I'm looking for. If I give it too much stimulus, it's going to back away from that and try to protect itself from that stimulus being applied. Because it knows if too much exposure happens, it will be injured or killed. So it's going to back away from that. So if those ideas that most practitioners are already familiar with, if we can apply those, but on a more specific and more frequent basis, they can guide us into the world of neurology, even with little or no neuroeducation. Because we can learn how the nervous system is responding to the physical training and exercises that we're doing.
Right.
That's a neurological response, especially when it's measured after every set, because we're not going to see a structural change in that amount of time. Obviously we're seeing a functional change, right? And functional changes are driven by the nervous system adaptations, not because we've changed the muscular tissues or the connective tissues or the structure of the body in 30 seconds, you know, not unless you get out your sledgehammer and made a permanent change.
Going back to that sort of nature nurture piece, maybe to sort of wrap up here a little bit, is do you think that there are, or when we look at these kinds of what would some people would call adrenaline athletes versus the more sort of steady eddy kind of athletes and things, do you think these are because their neurological system has been sort of biased by a particular stimulus or approach throughout their lives that they've gained or biased towards that, or that they just are what they are? And so there's this individual differences reality that we have to, in essence, respect about each athlete. Like one athlete is more, you know, the type of stimulus they're going to receive and experience is going to create a different change or a different net benefit than another based on kind of their starting point, if you gather where I'm coming from.
It's always going to be different. Every athlete is an individual. It's always one size fits one, not one size fits all. We absolutely have to respect the individual nervous system. But I think that it is, if we take a snapshot of an athlete today, the way they are today is because of all the experiences they've been through up to this point. Mm-hmm. So yes, some athletes are going to need heavier load before their nervous system even starts to respond. Some are going to need to have more intensity, which might drive that adrenal response. Some will need more, you might call it calm or even passive stimulus before their nervous system will really kick into gear. Mm. So we need an assessment process with each individual to find out what do they need so that we can begin to supply that within the confines or within the structure of whatever kind of training that we're doing. Mm-hmm. Right? I don't think we're necessarily born with those tendencies. Mm-hmm. I think they mostly come from our experiences, that our nervous system is trained to perceive and interpret a chemical state or an emotional state or a state of physical intensity as like, this is when performance happens. Mm. And so for some people to get into their highest level of performance, they have to first get into that certain state, which their nervous system has been trained and learned and eventually probably has habituated in order to gain that high level of performance. Right. But that's different for every individual athlete. Mm-hmm. So maybe that answers the question.
Yeah, no. I don't think that there's a perfect answer to it. I think we're all discovering this stuff, and I love your take on it. So I think it's high value where you're going with things. If somebody wants to learn some of the stuff that you're doing, where do they find you? How do they do that?
The best place to find me right now is actually on Facebook. My website's undergoing revisions, so it's kind of in a big black box of its own right now. But on Facebook, they can find me. My Facebook and actually my Instagram handle is at madamus.bush.
Madamus.bush.
Yeah, years ago, I had a friend who called me Madamus Maximus, and it stuck. So,
awesome.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's been awesome discovering what has contributed to your thought process and where you're headed with things. And I like the stuff I've been introduced to from you already and look forward to future learnings from you. And thanks for taking the time to spend an hour with me today.
Absolutely. It's been an honor. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Have a great day.
Thank you, Scotty.
Thanks for joining us today on Leave Your Mark. I hope we've left a mark on you today, and we wish only that you pay it forward by sharing this story, taking the time to rate and comment on this podcast. Please follow us at Twitter at Built by Scott and Instagram at King O'Payne, and become a member of this community at Scott G. Livingston on Facebook. Have a great day. Music by Cedric de Saint-Rome.